Just a question about the children, because obviously within the culture, we have, you know, three sons, cradle Catholics, came to church, and then they move away from their own particular reason. Do you find that belonging to the Jewish community tends to keep children sort of more engaged with the religion? It's just that idea of how that impacts.
It's a really good question. There's no guarantee. Let's assume it's a success. Let's assume we want our children to remain within the faith and to practice. We all want them to practice as we do. We know that's not going to happen. So it's always either more or less, but never the same. But yes, we aspire for our children to grow in that way. And we have a Jewish educational system, Jewish schools, starting at nursery, working all the way up to A levels and beyond. In this country, I'm not talking about having to go abroad for that. But sending children to a Jewish school also is no guarantee. That there are now enough Jewish day school places in primary schools in London to serve the Jewish community. It's been phenomenal growth over the last 20 years in school places, in Jewish schools. But it doesn't mean that all those children are going to go away and become, you know, retain the faith. There's a lack of practice in many Jewish homes. If you go back 100 years or so, till the post-war period, Jewish practice was centered on the home. Again, talk about the role of women. It was absolutely key. That was where the Jewish home, that was the center of Jewish life. People practiced accordingly and did all their things, and it's all based on the home. That's one of the reasons why I've invited you to the home, because it's a much more interesting experience than going to the synagogue, I think. I'm not sure I'll stay at home and go to shul. But that was the centre. And therefore, most of the people that I engage with who are in their 60s, 70s and 80s and beyond will tell me that they remember their grandmother and how religious she was. And none of them are as religious as their grandmother ever was. Right? That's just the way it is. That there's been a general decline. Certainly in the Anglo-Jewish community, away from the Haredi groups, the ultra-Orthodox, which is a terrible term, but that sort of end of the spectrum. There's been a gradual decline in Jewish practice, and therefore all these people tell me how religious their grandmothers were. And what I normally say to them is, well, how religious are your grandchildren? Where do you want them to go? And they say, oh, well, my grandchildren go to Jewish day school. And that's not enough. Because the shift from the home has been from the home to the synagogue. And for most of these, the last 40, 50, 60 years, the synagogue has been the center of Jewish life. And now it's shifted again away from the synagogue into the school. You're getting further and further from the home. And therefore, the ideals that people are being taught in school, most of you will not have Jewish children in your classes when you teach them about Judaism. It's going to be an alien language, and it's an alien subject. Unfortunately, even in Jewish areas, there are Jewish children being taught about Judaism where it's just as alien, because when they go home, they don't see that practice. When they go to synagogue, if they ever go to synagogue 3 times a year, normally for the high holidays, they don't engage because they just don't get it. Most of them will leave the primary school at 10 or 11 and go on to a non-Jewish secondary school, and they'll lose the little bit they had. It's a very hard reality, I think, nowadays of Jewish life. It's really difficult. So that's one of the challenges we face as a community, is trying to reinvigorate the youth and re-engage them and try and get it to the point that their grandparents were less religious than they were. That's the real challenge. And that, I suppose, brings us into the synagogue, which I think, in terms of worship, as we say, the idea of prayer, having dealt with the fact that we've got the men downstairs, the women upstairs in our synagogue, not always it's like that. Sometimes it's on the same level, but there's always some sort of barrier in Orthodox synagogues between the men and the women. There's two reasons for that. The first is that it's a distraction to pray with people that don't need to pray. And again, women don't need to be in the synagogue. You don't have to do that. You can pray your own way at home just as comfortably. You don't need the communal element to it. And secondly, because in a sense, it mimics the temple service. In the temple times, so you would go to the temple, you would bring the sacrifice, if you wanted to. Sometimes you just go along to see what was happening, to be part of that experience. And the temple was the focal point of Jewish practice and Jewish worship, certainly the first temple period. And in the temple, you had the men would be on the ground level, and the women were in balconies around the side, so they had a better view of what was going on. And therefore, that style has been sort of subconsciously mimicked in many synagogues, with the women looking down on the proceedings, as it were, on the men downstairs. So that's one of the reasons, that almost like a cultural reason for that division. But we would separate the men away for that, for the other reason, that it's just it's not what men need while they're praying. They need to pray as a group and to focus their attention on their prayers, and they need each other more than they need anyone else around. So the style of prayer, the prayer book, as we say, so we follow an order of service. Three times a day, Shacharit, Mincha, Maariv, the morning prayer, the afternoon prayer, the evening prayer. We have a special prayer called Musaf, which is added on the Shabbat and the High Holy Days, on the holidays, and on the new moon. And then we have another prayer called Ne'ilah, which is said once a year on Yom Kippur. So Yom Kippur, we have five different sets of prayers. Other holy days we have four, and on a regular work day we have three. The structure of the prayer is fundamentally the same. There's the Amidah, which is the centerpiece of prayer. The Amidah is, during the weekday, is 19 blessings, which you can read in any of the prayer books, or online if you wanted to. Online is a great resource, by the way.
We've said some about it,
yeah. lots of great stuff on there, and so most of it's translated into English as well as many other languages, so people can really pray in their own language, or you know, understand the prayers before they pray in Hebrew, however it works. In the synagogue, we tend to pray mainly in Hebrew, a little bit of Aramaic, and in fact, there's one piece that we say in Aramaic on the Shabbat. We read from the Torah scroll, which is the books of Moses, and when we put it back, there's a piece we say in Aramaic. I was a couple of years ago, when I was doing my masters, we went to the John Mylands Library in Manchester, and they were showing us fragments from the Geniza, from the Cairo deposit. There's hundreds of thousands of fragments of interest from dating from the 7th century onwards. And it was discovered about 150 years ago by a guy called Schachter, and over time it's been studied. So she showed us, one of the professors there showed us a fragment of a book, of a piece of something that she said came from a child's book for instruction, because it was big letters, and therefore it must have been an educational aid. Because we say this prayer every week, we recognize that. We said, no, that's not what it is. It's Aramaic. And probably what you're looking at is a poster that was put on the wall. Because it wasn't in the vernacular, it had been the vernacular. Aramaic was the vernacular many years before, but there was a tradition starting sometime in the medieval era, maybe earlier, to put the less common prayers that were said on the wall, because they wouldn't have had access to prayer books for everyone before the printing press. So the harder prayers to say would have been stuck on the wall, and that's how people would have said them. So this was probably a poster. And when we look on the back, you can actually see that it looked like it would have been hung. So we're probably right. And that gave them, they started looking at other pieces in a different way as a result of that observation. It was just an interesting point that for us it was an obvious thing. But you know, looking at it academically, that just hadn't occurred to them. That's just about some cultural knowledge input. But the idea that these prayers are, you know, there's a few prayers that aren't in Hebrew, most of them are. We also say a prayer for the royal family in English, and we say a prayer for Israel, which we happen to say in Hebrew, but many communities say that in English as well, for peace in the Holy Land. But the vast majority of the public prayer is in Hebrew. Many people don't read Hebrew very well, and this is one of the frustrations we have. Bet Knesset, which is the name for a synagogue, actually means a house of meeting. Bet Knishta is the Aramaic term, which same thing. Synagogue is a Greek word, But Bet Knesset means a place where people came together. And the origin of the Bet Knesset was during the Second Temple period. Remember I described how a few of the Jews came over from Persia back to the land of Israel, leaving behind many, many thousands of, hundreds of thousands of Jews in Babylon and Persia. So they had to form their own way of connecting, as it were, with the temple. So they decided, right, well, at the time the temple is doing stuff, we will gather together and we will talk about that stuff, as it were. And so that's how prayer was formed at that time. The Anshe Knesset HaGdolah, the men of the Great Assembly, 120 sages, including Mordechai from the Purim story, Mordechai and Esther. So Mordechai was one of those, and they formulated many of the prayers that we say today. I went to the British Museum a couple of years ago, and they had an exhibition of Haggadot, the book that we read on Passover. They also had in the side room there the Magna Carta. So I went in to look at the Magna Carta first. I was interested in what it looked like. If you've ever done it, you try and read it, you can't read it. It's English, but not as we know it. It's just, you know, it's illegible. Then I walked out of that room, was it 12:15? Walked out into the main room, and Haggadot from the same era, I could read it. It's not changed. In 800 years, there hasn't been there's been no change. Not just in the language, in the style of writing the language, but actually in the words that we pray. Now, that's 800 years, but I can go back another 800 years and I'll still find the same thing. And go back to the Taniyatic era, I can read in the Mishnah prayers that we say today. We've kept them relevant, we've kept them with us all through these times. So it's ancient prayers in Hebrew, but many people now, they struggle with the Hebrew, either because their grandparents were more religious than they were, they may have gone to non-Jewish schools, which was, as I say before, you know, before 20 years ago, most people would have ended up in non-Jewish schools at some point, if not for most, if not all of their school careers. And coming from homes where the parents maybe weren't so hot on Hebrew either. And it just wasn't a done thing. So there's been a decline in Hebrew reading. And it's a problem that we need to address. But for the moment, we pray in Hebrew. The Bet Knesset, the place of gathering, which started out of just an idea of bringing Jews together to commemorate prayer, in a sense, commemorate worship in the temple, gradually developed their own styles of praying. But also, that initial social drive was never lost. And so if you were in the synagogue, please God you'll come at some point in a few weeks or whenever it happens to be, you might be quite taken aback by how little praying is going on. I'll be up there bellowing it out, and people on the sides talking about the football. And you know, it's just that sense of a social occasion rather than worshipful prayer actually is quite strong. One of the only parts that I would suggest that everyone could understand is my sermon, which is quite a pressure. You know, they're coming for a 2-hour service, although most of them probably could just come for the last 45 minutes. Because again, they'll drop in, drop out, so they'll pop in and show their head and then go on security for an hour and a half. stand on the door and chat to everyone coming in. But you know, the sermon is one of the few things that they could theoretically at least walk away with something that they've understood and grasped, and that's a weight of responsibility on my shoulders to give them something meaningful or impactful in that time. Sometimes I'll try and focus their minds for the next part of the prayer and say, you know, we're all here to pray, let's at least do some of it, for the next 5 minutes, let's just look at the prayer book, find something in it that you relate to, Hebrew, English, I don't care, just find something there that's meaningful, and use that as your platform to pray. Use that as the basis for something to think about. Think about God for a few minutes. They tell the story about the guy who is doing a sociological study of the major religions. So he goes into a church, and he approaches a Christian who's praying. He says, "Excuse me, are you Christian?" He says, "Yes, of course I am." He says, "Can you tell me you believe in God?" He says, "Yes, of course. I'm praying. Why would I? Why else would I be here?" He goes into a mosque and he asks someone, "Excuse me, you're Muslim?" He says, "Yeah, of course." He says, "And your belief in God?" He says, "Absolute, of course. Why else would I be here?" He goes into a synagogue in Yom Kippur and he says to a Jew, "Excuse me, you're Jewish?" He says, "Who's asking?" He says, yes, I'm Jewish. He says, do you believe in God? He says, believe in God? You think I'm a rabbi? Go speak to the rabbi. You know, it's a very loose association sometimes. In Gateshead, I would suggest it's not, when you, again, moving towards people that understand the prayer book, that are practicing Jews, that are Orthodox Jews, that are observant Jews. Then you talk about people that really get it to a greater or lesser degree. But at least their familiarity with the prayer book and with prayers and the rules about when you ought to talk, when you can talk, when you shouldn't talk in prayer are more important. But for most communities in Anglo-Jewry, most people who come to synagogue don't have that level of engagement. So worship, the difference between Jewish worship and Christian worship, that's which is particularly what you're asking, is very simple. If you go into a church, that's Christian worship. If you go to a synagogue and you talk about the football, that's Jewish worship.